You're listening to a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. So tonight we are presenting writers who are not only extremely talented, but also very enterprising. This is a collective, the Glass Table Collective, of diverse LA-based writers and artists. The collective includes poets and fiction writers, essayists, political activists, a painter, and a filmmaker. And just from spending time with them in the green room and observing their interactions, I can say that observing their interactions together, they evince generosity, a spirit of improvisation, and a respect for each other's work. It's really a delight to see them work together as we're figuring out the frame of the evening, because Gronk, who was supposed to be here tonight, is not able to make it. But we will have Gail will show some of his work and talk about his contributions to the collective. So why form a collective? What does it mean in publishing to cut the distributor middleman? These are some of the questions that the four members of the collective here tonight will discuss with Susan Salter Reynolds, book critic and longtime Los Angeles Times feature writer. You probably know Susan through her Discoveries column in the Los Angeles Times Book Review, which is now part of the calendar section. It's an essential place I check in with frequently. She spots new talent. She's an incredible writer, and we're very, very grateful to have her here tonight to moderate. We'll take, as I said, your questions at the end of the discussion. I wanted to mention all the names of the Glass Table Collective because we have just a sampling of them up here tonight. The Glass Table Collective consists of the writers Molly Bendel, Francois Camoin, Kevin Cantwell, A.W. Dianuntis, and excuse my pronunciation, I'm trying to get them all right, Ramon Garcia, Catherine Hake, Karen Kevorkian, Alicia Partnoy, Chuck Rosenthal, Gail Ronsky, and the artist Gronk and Antonio Leva. We are going to start tonight with Gail Ronsky, who is going to tell us a little bit about the contribution of Gronk to the collective. And as a visual artist, Gail is the author, co-author, or translator of 9 books of poetry and prose, including Dying for Beauty, Poems for Infidels, and Volando Bajito, among others. And she teaches creative writing at Loyola Marymount University. Following Gail's reading, we'll hear from Alicia Partnoy. Alicia is a survivor of Argentina's detention camps during the dictatorship in the late 1970s. She's best known for Little School, The Little School, Tales of Disappearance and Survival. She also published the poetry collection Little Low Flying, Volando Bajito, and her most recent book is the translation of Gail Ronsky's poetry collection, So Quick, Bright Things. Revised order here. Ramon Garcia will follow. He's the author of a book of poetry, Other Countries. He's published his poems in a variety of journals and anthology, and it was Ramon who first proposed this evening to me, and I'm very grateful for him and very happy it's come to fruition. His new book of poetry is Other Countries, and he is a professor in the Chicano Studies at California State University, Northridge. And our final reader for the evening will be Chuck Rosenthal, the author of 8 novels, a memoir, and most recently a travel book, Are We Not There Yet? Travels in Nepal, North India, and Bhutan. He teaches fiction writing and apparently also, what do you call it, your road class at Loyola Marymount? Road writing. He is the manager of the Glass Table Artists Collective and the managing editor of What Books Press. So please join me in welcoming Gail Ronsky and the members of the Glass Table Collective. Thank you.
Okay, hi. Thank you all so much for coming, and thanks, Louise, for having us. We've been really excited about this for a long time, and I'm really sorry that Gronk isn't here. He's stuck in Orange County in some kind of disaster. I mean, not something horrible but that we have to worry about, but, you know, just something that prevented him from being here. And he's really, I mean, I hate to say this, guys, but the most charismatic of all of us. So, you know, I feel kind of bad. I'm not going to be as funny. I can't name drop as many famous people as he can. But anyway, these are the covers that Gronk has done the artwork for the books we've published so far. And we started as a collective meeting at Gronk's place because Gronk is a good friend of Ramon's, and he's social and hospitable in that way. And he, for the first couple of meetings, just listened to us. And then slowly we noticed he was drawing while we were talking. And then when we started talking about the books we were going to publish and things, he started laying out artwork. And eventually, you know, because we weren't bold enough to say, oh, I want that on my cover, he said to us, choose from these pieces of art for your covers. And so we all went and grabbed something that we loved, and, you know, they fit remarkably well. And then we had help designing the books. Karen Kevorkian, one of our members, designed books for years for the DeYoung Art Museum in San Francisco, and we have a woman named Ashley who does the actual, you know, putting together the e-files and everything for the pages and the covers. And so I think design was always a very important thing for us. We wanted not only to publish books that had good content, but also were beautiful to look at. And so that's why it's amazing for us that Gronk decided to become a member of the collective. And one of the things then, after we published our first bunch of books, Gronk volunteered a book of drawings, which is this, a giant claw. It's such a great, weird cover. I mean, you know, he didn't want the title on the cover. And he asked me to write an introduction or foreword to the book. And so to introduce Gronk's work, I'm going to read a little bit from the foreword. In The Giant Claw, which is a sci-fi movie made in 1957 by Sam Katzman, the monster, a bird bigger than a battleship that comes from some godforsaken antimatter galaxy light years and light years from Earth, is so badly rendered, it's beyond comical. In fact, when the movie premiered, lead actor Jeff Morrow, who plays the character Mitch, you're going to see a little bit of this movie, who hadn't yet seen any of the special effects, slipped out of the theater early so no one would recognize him. This movie, says Gronk, is my Citizen Kane, in tribute to which, partly, he created this book, A Giant Claw. Drawing for Gronk is writing, or perhaps writing is drawing, and so he has drawn a book. I would call it a book of poetry if I had to choose a genre, because it's written in a language of images, because each page has the kind of organized fragility that poems do. Someone else might call it a postmodern, nonlinear novel, or a book of art criticism. There are declamatory divisions of line and space here, narratives of metamorphosis, the creation of a new aleph bet made of quirky symbols, some from outer space. In her book, Lyric Poetry, The Pain and Pleasure of Words, Mutluk Konik Blazing writes, The poet accepts the intimacy of the symbolic and recalls in the sounds of words a prehistoric intimacy of the body and language, both dissolving and reinstituting symbolic language as beautiful illusion. I want to argue that in this book of poetic drawings, Gronk accomplishes something similar. Certainly, we find prehistoric intimacy of the body and language here, as well as an intimacy of the symbolic. The term symbolic meaning for me, I suppose, anything representational, which can be experienced by us as something simultaneously remembered and forgotten, something simultaneously arriving and vanishing from view. Gronk's drawings create a space in which our hard-to-access verbal selves are reminded that the world we experience through language is beautiful illusion, that body and form are constantly in flux, constantly being dissolved and reinstituted. And what does any of this have to do with The Giant Claw, with Mitch McPhee and Mademoiselle Mathematician, who you'll be meeting? The valiant actors Mara Corday and Jeff Morrow, the cheesy homemade monster from outer space. I think maybe, finally, Gronk might just really like the movie. Okay, so if you can play the clip, you'll see what I've been talking about. Yeah, right. That is such a hard act to follow. Anyway, so now I'm going to read a couple of poems, and then we'll move through the group. Everyone will read just a little bit and give you an idea of what's in these books, and then Susan will begin a conversation. So I'm going to start by reading a poem from Karen Kevorkian's book, which came out last year and which has, I think, such an exquisite cover and also exquisite poetry inside. Here's a poem called I Was Not Listening. I was not listening. I was remembering small lights strung in the dark by a narrow river, reflections like fireflies ricocheting off smooth water that was both brown and green, like a mirror in a dark room that the headlights of turning cars ply with light. The shivering of my yellow skirt in warm, still air, whatever it was I was waiting for, how palm fronds and banana leaves shone slickly like swords. She was remembering when not 20, she lost her job, and her tears, and her brother saying, "Go dress up," taking her to a hotel roof garden where a dance band played, and there was a little breeze, a paste of talcum between her breasts and her thighs, an ice cube she ran across her throat, across the back of her neck. I will read one poem from Bling and Fringe, which is a book co-written by me and Molly Bendall. And it's a lot of fun, a lot of experimental stuff going on with typography and shapes and sounds. Rain, the Image. Epitaphs, dust, our paper, the title's arbitrariness, a filmy thinness, non-place, in person, an absence, ascending, over here, over there, a pipe, a key, a leaf, a glass, I love you, juxtaposition of horse and armchair, the sorcery of his silhouette, a revelation, not unlike, no two alike, exotic, dancer, hairstyles, the fall fashion, after the rain came, it all unraveled, losing, loosening, the word as noose, a smattering of glitter on the pavement. Thank you. Okay, I'm not one of those poets who says, oh, don't clap. Okay, and just a couple poems from So Quick, Bright Things, which is my newest book. And this book has characters from Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream, although kind of set in contemporary times. And the story behind this book is that I was renting a studio above the Theatricum Botanicum in Topanga Canyon, and they spent all summer rehearsing and then performing A Midsummer Night's Dream, so lines just kept flying up into the air, and I just grabbed them, put them in poems. Okay. Scenes of Mad Love. Days laid down like rags around their feet. Titania stands with Oberon looking at the ruin of ruins in Mexico. A fountain in the middle of the room. Nothing in the world but rain. Nothing in the world but rain and rags and their two beings rotating, totally washed. And this is the real place. Rub it till it tears you apart. Couple with their heads full of clouds. After their brush with death, but before either Titania or Oberon had spent any time in Puck's yurt, tripping their brains out, reliving their births, this was the time they referred to as clockwork and despair. Statues were, in fact, looking at them knowingly. Seafoam was made of gypsy omens and cigar smoke, but it was what things were not that made them difficult then. What they were not was magical. And now I'm going to invite Alicia Partnoy up, and I will read one last poem from this book, and Alicia will read her translation. This is called Afternoon of a Fawn.
La tarde del fauno.
How beautiful his haunches.
Cuán bella su grupa.
How sleek his horns.
Qué sedosos sus cuernos.
How awkwardly he moves along the dance floor.
Cuán torpemente se mueve por la pista de baile.
Clicking in the direction of Titania, who's wearing a diaphanous caftan and blue wings.
Al trotecito en dirección a Titania, quien viste un caftán diáfano y alas azules.
It's somebody's quinceañera.
Son los sweet 16 de alguien.
Fairy babies in tiaras, girls dressed like Lady Baltimore cake.
Haditas con tiara, niñas vestidas como la torta de Lady Baltimore.
A flamenco house band plays Amor Milagroso.
Un conjunto de rock toca Stairway to Heaven.
But Titania has done the math.
Pero Titania ha hecho las cuentas.
And simple vanity prevents her from pursuing her Nijinsky like a pack of hunting dogs into the woods behind the Belle Époque pavilion.
Pero Titania ha hecho las cuentas y la simple vanidad le impide perseguir a su Nijinsky como jauría de perros cazadores rumbo al bosque detrás del kiosco de música estilo Belle Époque.
Thank you very much.
Uy, qué lindo, buenas tardes. Gracias por venir. I'm going to read from Volando Bajito because Gail Ronsky translated this. The Windmills of Memory. Across the road from the secret detention center, the little school where I was disappeared in 1977, there was a broken windmill. The military had tied it up with wire. Young draftees were terrorized when forced to stand on guard there. They knew that even on calm, breezeless nights, the windmill's blades could break loose and rotate on their own. Legend had it. We all know legends tell always the truth. That the windmill was moved by the spirit of the disappeared. In 1998, 22 years after my release from the little school, I went back to the site of the concentration camp. I saw the windmill, but the spirit of my soulmates, Vasquita, Corta, María Eugenia, and Néstor, and those of my other compañeros, María Elenita, Graciela, who gave birth in captivity, Benja, Braco, their spirits did not move the windmill. Instead, they followed me to my house in Los Angeles. A few days later, while going to work on my bike, I wrote a poem. When I saw it on the page, I realized it was shaped as a gun. I remembered the lines by Spanish poet Gabriel Celaya, "Poetry is a weapon loaded with future." Then I asked the weapon, Celaya, what if it's aimed at the future? ¿Y si el arma, Celaya, apuntara al futuro? ¿Sobre qué muertos echaremos qué culpas cuando se nos desteja la trama del silencio? ¿Cuáles serán las puertas para la cruz de sangre y cuáles las solapas de estrellas amarillas? ¿De qué gargantas frías rapiñaremos voces para que sean el eco de lo que dijo el amo? ¿Qué perdón, qué justicia humanamente posible atarán con alambre los molinos de nuestra memoria? Upon what dead shall we place what blame when the warp and woof of our silence is unwoven? What doors will be chosen for the cross of blood and which will be the lapels for the yellow stars? From what cold throats will we scavenge voices in order to echo what the tyrant said? What pardon, what humanly possible justice will bind with wire the windmills of our memory. And I'm going to read from the forthcoming Fuegos Florales, Flowering Fire, that Wet Books is going to publish next year. Ars Political, Arte Politica. There is a reference to Adorno, adornment in English, but Adorno, and you will know if you heard about writing about poetry after the Holocaust. There is a reference to ESMA. It was the biggest concentration camp in Argentina, where about 5,000 people disappeared and were killed. Arte Política, un verso desnudo de todo malabar y adorno, a verse stripped of all manipulation and adornment, para que nadie diga que después de Auschwitz, so that no one can say it after Auschwitz, que después de la conquista, que después de tantas diminutas esmas, de tantas pequeñitas sabras y yatilas de Ruanda, de Kosovo, de todas las faluyas bombardeadas, after Auschwitz, after the conquest, after so many diminutive esmas, so many tiny sabras and shatilas and Rwandas and Kosovos, all of the bombed out faluyas, so that no one can say, para que nadie diga, nothing remains, que nada que decir, for us to say, nothing still dryly cuts apart the brain, the tongue, and whatever other viscera are given the luxury of throbbing with pain. Que nada ya nos parte en seco el cerebro, la lengua y alguna que otra víscera que se da el lujo de palpitar los duelos. Gracias.
Hi, thank you all for coming. I want to thank Luis for inviting us. And for keeping literary culture alive and having such good taste and being a wonderful writer, too. And I want to thank also Susan for agreeing to be on a panel with us and sort of according us the legitimacy and prestige we have in our own heads, but it's nice for it to be, officially sanctioned by Susan. I'm going to read a few poems from my book, Other Countries. I should say something about Gronkh's planetarium piece, which is what's screening right now. It's meant to be seen in a planetarium, so you're not getting the full effect, but it's very beautiful. It's, I believe, a sort of animation, some very new technology that I have no knowledge of, but I watched it in the planetarium. It was really wonderful. So if it screens again, I really recommend it. The first poem that I'm going to read is entitled The Prodigal Son Comes Home. There are a few biblical poems in this book, as well as some fairy tales, because I'm very fond of both. I grew up with both sort of mythical narratives. The prodigal son comes home. They rejoice without noticing. I sleepwalk in memories of cities, music, sex, drunkenness. I am back where I ended, amid innocence and injustice. No more will I see the sunrise over polluted oceans, Paris in dreams of gold as the sun dies, the madhouse of Los Angeles's downtown, the moody lights of the nightclubs and the headlights of traffic at night, the splendor of foreign faces, and the lips of strangers offering themselves forever or for one night. There is peace in the fields, silence in the house, work to be done, love to give back. My life was lived away from here. This next poem is entitled The Summer of Jaws. So this might be over some people's heads when if they're much younger than we are. But this was a kind of seminal movie from my childhood. Jaws, I'm still kind of fond of it, but it's entitled The Summer of Jaws. It was a summer of Jaws. The beach loomed to a spooky soundtrack on the screen at the McHenry Cinema. A real shark came to the valley that summer. In the 115-degree heat of the Montgomery Ward's parking lot, a huge trailer with a life-size shark painted on the entirety of its sides lured viewers to a real-life Jaws, the big screen's shark doppelganger inside. Tia Lisa took my brother and me to see the shark on a scorching afternoon. She was the most Americanized of the tias, the most permissive. She had let us in to watch Saturday Night Fever. The great terrible creature inside the freezing trailer was a marvel. Its jaws opened for us to gape into, with teeth as real as the fish stench, a cold, dead dream visiting the stagnant enchantment of our childhood. This poem is entitled Manuel. I knew him when his beauty was all of a piece, his high cheekbones, the empty radiance of his good looks, the impeccable smile of a Mexican boy from Modesto. I last saw him entering a Goodwill store. Out of curiosity, I followed him in. Carrying a soiled backpack, he talked to himself. The girl at the cash register made a sour face. Was he homeless? It was not age that marred his face. Madness ravaged him, drugs and self-betrayal. He was not all there. Once he had danced under eternal disco lights, glamour dizzying around him with enviable promises. Nothing was real. Nothing is real still, but the beauty is gone and the music and the sparkling lights. I didn't want him to recognize me. I ran out into the suburban streets we both had come from. And I'm just going to end with this poem entitled Hollywood. Beautiful Tracy Greer lived stately in her madness, walking the halls at Crestwood Manor in an evening gown, a fur coat, high-heeled, wearing diamonds and pearls like ginger on Gilligan's Island. Insisting glamour was a religion to mercilessly give oneself to, with her back to the yellow wall, statuesquely, she stood for hours, worshiping the void. I remember her flawless skin, her radiance, which was the same as the only star sighting I've had in L.A. Walking home one day on Spring Street, Christina Ricci sat in the passenger seat of a vintage American car, her eyes blacked out by large bug-like sunglasses, her glowing skin perfect and glowing, a star in the prison house of the city. Thank you. And Chuck Rosenthal is next.
Science. Now some ordinary language. I too want to thank Louise for having us, and thank you for being here. I'd also like to say that this is in some ways a culmination and makes me realize, after a lot of hard work, I've come to love so many of the members, all the members of this collective, the way you can only love people you fight with all the time. This is, I have a new book out called Coyote O'Donoghue's History of Texas. It's historical fabulism. It's a history of Texas, but quite made up, because I'm not a realist writer. I'm a romantic writer. I'm going to read from my book, Are We Not There Yet? Travels in Nepal, North India, and Bhutan. And Louise, this was a product of Roadwrite. Gail and I took 13 Loyola students and traveled in the Himalayas for 4 months. Don't do that. Two things you might want to know here, just a little ahead of time. This does reiterate Jack Kerouac climbing the Horsetail Falls with Gary Snyder, which he didn't make it to the top, and here neither do I. And the concept of emptiness, which is a Buddhist concept. At least in Los Angeles, you can use that word Buddha, and people know what you mean. invented by the philosopher Nagarjuna in 500 CE, founder of the Majjhimaka school, in which the foundation of all reality underneath all this, which is illusion, is emptiness, and underneath that is more emptiness, just like the turtles. Okay, so we're in Bhutan here, and I am at the end of climbing up to the top to see the tiger's nest. You've seen that, right? Enough travel channels. Gail Ronsky is Diosa in this, and my daughter's name is Jesus, which she went by that name from about fifth grade through college. Made all our professors at Loyola call her Jesus. All right, this isn't that, I'm a pretty funny guy, but this isn't that funny. I'd always been bad with heights. As I aged, it got worse, and now, in the Himalayas, confronted with it daily, it only got worse. Every time I looked around, I was on the edge of something, though I hadn't fallen off anything yet. But I feared that confronted with too much space and not enough protection from it, a railing, something, I might not make it. But I'd come this far. I'd keep going. On my left, I passed a one-room cottage, a half-cave built into the cliff. I looked inside. A monk sat next to a 3-foot-tall prayer wheel, a cylinder inscribed with petitions for the diminishment of karma. One turn of a prayer wheel can release karma thousands of times faster than an ordinary prayer. Monasteries and sometimes big stupas were usually surrounded by hundreds of them. Supplicants walked around the perimeter clockwise, turning one wheel after another. Sometimes in the Himalayas, roads or streets were lined with them, as well as tall willowy prayer flags and little square prayer flags draped on the lines above. Sometimes, out of nowhere, you found mountainsides draped with prayer flags. Like stupas, prayer wheels could be as small as a Coke can or as large as a house. In terms of your karma, the bigger the better. In the Buddhist Himalayas, religion is everywhere, religion to the bone. I bowed to the priest. Tashidelik, I said. That's hello in Tibetan. Tashidelik, said the priest. Good luck. Then I walked around a huge rock where, on the other side, the path ended. Across the way, about 200 feet below me, the monastery loomed, gigantic, clinging impossibly to the opposite cliff. Between me and the tiger's nest, a swooning drop of 2,000 feet. If you've seen pictures, this is where they're taken from. I leaned into the side of the cliff, away from the empty space, and started down. The sky fell away. I paused. Below me, Diosa and Jesus walked on the ledge behind a low railing. A railing. Hope. I saw some of the kids now on the porch outside the monastery. Tom, who was our TA, spotted me and waved, "Come on!" I stepped around another corner, the emptiness beckoning, and came to a rock stairway about 2 feet wide. On my left, the cliff wall. On my right, nothing. My hand on the cliff wall, I stepped down. The abyss raced at me. My knees shook. I backed up, stood still. Tom spotted me and waved again. Diosa and Jesus made it to the monastery. Everybody who'd come this far had traversed the ravine. Several kids didn't make it. I stepped again. The air swam at me. The emptiness spun. For a moment, it was as if I'd fallen into it. I stepped back. If it were possible for me to look away, I could do it, but you couldn't step onto the stairs looking down at them and not down into the drop. I stepped down again, one step, two, my head swam, my knees quivered, then buckled. I sat down. The drop-off everywhere around me now, I pushed myself back up the steps, butt first. I reached the top and turned away. At the top of the steps, I took a final gaze at the tiger's nest below me. It was as close as I was going to get. Why could everybody else do it? I fought with my humiliation. I could try again, then what? Was I running from my fear by turning my back or facing it? Disappointed, I walked back toward the rock temple where the monks stood in the doorway. Already back, the man said. I need a flying tiger, I said. That's the myth, is that Padmasambhava crossed over to the cliff on the back of a flying tiger. He could fly by himself. Why he needed a tiger, I don't know. I need a flying tiger, I said. Me too, the monk said. Now I saw that the priest looked at my... The priests looked about my age, maybe a little older. Sometimes with these monks, like nuns, it was hard to tell their age. He wore the uniform, orange robe, maroon cowl, sandals. "You haven't been there?" I said. "Never," said the monk. "Why should I?" "It's the holiest place in the world," I said. "Holy," said the monk. "What isn't? Besides, it's a replica." "Everything is," I said. I followed the monk inside where the priest turned the prayer wheel counterclockwise. "Opposite," I said. "Bon." There were still Bon animists in the Himalayas. In fact, they are very common among the Sherpas, and unlike the Tibetans, the Bon circled the temples and turned the prayer wheels counterclockwise. "Do you think it matters?" The monk sat down and began opening envelopes. He'd extract a piece of paper, read from it, then light a candle and turn the wheel, chanting, "Om Mani Padme Hum," jewel inside the lotus. I watched him. I didn't want to interfere, but it looked like I wasn't interfering. Prayer for our well-being, our salvation, for those we love, for miracles, for all sentient beings trapped in this painful Maya world. Prayer. I must have mumbled it. The monk stopped and looked at me. One act of sympathy can produce another act of sympathy and step by step change the world, he said. It might be baloney, but it's important baloney. He laughed, that Tibetan Buddha's joy laugh, completely pure. Would you like some tea? I sat. I hated tea. But this was too important, talking to this priest. After reeling from my failure, in silence, the priest boiled the water on a small brazier, poured the water into cups. We drank the tea. Have the others dropped by? I said. They had other things on their mind, said the priest. Maybe on their way back, I said. It will be late, the priest said. The sun is already going behind the mountain. I finished my tea. Danyabad, I said. Thank you. Then I said, the monastery is a replica? The monk told me that the original monastery was built in the 15th century. 10 years ago, it burnt down completely and was rebuilt. Helicopters and cranes, the monk said. A tourist attraction. The miracles of one generation become commonplace to another. But the cave is there, I said. There's a cave, said the priest. Yes, a cave. Hang whatever you want on that. Anything between a holy miracle and a thrill ride in Bhutan land, the happiest place on earth. Are you going to try again? No, I said. I'm waiting for the tiger. Me too, the monk said. On the way back down, Patu, our guide, met me at the path to the rest house. I mentioned the monk, but Patu only twisted his features a little and said nothing. The whole way down, I felt an odd mixture of exhilaration and dismay. I didn't look back until I reached the bottom. Then I gazed up at the tiger's nest again, now a speck against the mountain. I'd come this far, all the way to Bhutan. I'd climbed to it, above it, but whatever it was, I couldn't get to it. Did it mean something? Nothing. I reached a field on the valley floor and walked into it, sat amidst the ruins of what seemed to have been a household. The sun set behind the mountains, and the forest turned gray. A woman walked by with a small girl who seemed to dance around her. She disappeared into the forest, then returned carrying wood. The little girl left her mother's side and wandered toward me. Her mother stopped and kept an eye on her child, who approached me cautiously, then put out her hand. I opened my palm. The girl touched it lightly with her fingertips. Her brown eyes, like the monk's, were infinite. Then dusk fell. I heard the adventurous voices of the kids echoing through the hills. I stood and met them in the woods. Just another monastery, Jesus said. On a cliff, said Tom. Let's get drunk and stoned, said Colin. Jesus is right. It's just another monastery, said Bernard. On a fucking hill, said Tom. On a cliff. I saw the cave and you didn't, Sarah said to me. She'd gone up on a pony, but she'd gone up on a pony. When I hit the stairs, I knew you wouldn't make it, Diosa said. The gray air turned cold. We walked toward the bus. I told Diosa about the little girl. You're getting sentimental, Diosa said. Romantic, I said. Then I told her about the monk in the cottage. At the top of the steps, she said. I was in there, I said. Not the one behind it, Diosa said. There's another one, I said. We were all in the first one, she said. With the prayer wheel, I said. That one was empty, Diosa said. The cottage at the top of the stairs, I said. I only saw one. You were upset, said Diosa. Maybe you got confused. I wasn't that upset, I said. We were all in there, she said. Everybody. It was empty. Empty, I said. But it didn't matter. I was somewhere. I'd been there with someone, even if I'd been awake and dreaming, a victim of my own desire to see something in the emptiness. Maybe the tiger had come for me. Thank you.
So questions, and then I can open it up. This is my phone now? When I was growing up, if you wanted to be a writer, God help you, there were a couple of portals you could squeeze through. There was the Hemingway Plath route. You know, you could drink yourself silly and then maybe squeeze it a couple of months and commit suicide. You could hope that the New Yorker would find you. You could send pieces out to literary journals and hope to hear back. You could maybe enter an MFA program. But it seems to me that part of the beauty of this thing you've created is that there are now more options, more ways for a writer to see their true work, you know, come to life. So I want to ask you. I want to begin by asking you all. Your public. You all have one foot in the old world. You all have won prizes and fellowships and published, you know, nationally. But you have one foot in this brave new world. So I want to hear a little bit about your publishing histories, your experience of publishing, and how you came to this point. So.
Well, I think most of us have done all those routes, so right. Probably have, you know, dozens and dozens of literary publications. I've got bunches of degrees, been rejected by the New Yorker, but also it drank myself to death, almost. I'm still working
here.
At that. I think I might succeed. it's getting late. So we, you know, we've done those things. We've been published in New York, and we've been published and translated right internationally. I think I can speak for all of us. But this did grow out a bit of frustration of the old model of trying to get that agent and convince that agent, and then rewrite something for the agent, and then the agent says, "Oh, change this," and you change that, and just change this, and you change that. They say, "Well, I don't think so." And that route, and I think people have traced the commercialization of New York writing over the last few decades, and so it's harder and harder, I think, to be to penetrate New York writing. And I think I was finding that the small press model was very similar to the New York model. The path seemed the same, and. Looked around and one night in discussion with a number of people here. Should I go on to that and say, oh, I said, wait a minute, there's another way to do this. Mm-hmm. This could be, people can, those people that are out there doing that, they're doing it. We could get together and do it. And I think that's when we made this step and came up with this idea with probably around the glass table, our glass table with Gail and Alicia and Antonio, and then started getting on the phone trying to talk to people and say, what about trying this?
One of the things that inspired us actually is the younger generation. You know, I mean, most people our ages have gone through that traditional thing, get MFA, send poems out, do all that. And, you know, we kind of noticed lately, like at the AWP, the Conference for Associated Writing Programs, that there are all of these people in graduate school still, or just out of graduate school, starting presses, starting journals. And there just seemed to be all of this new energy there all of a sudden. I think it's there very much, and it really has changed the landscape of the writing world in this country, whether, you know, anybody has noticed it beyond, you know, the AWP, I'm not sure. But that was very inspiring. And because all of us are people who have, all throughout our careers, had those conversations over and over again. Well, why don't we start a press? And all of a sudden it seemed doable. Mm-hmm. Because of the changes in technology and distribution, it seemed doable.
For me, it's more an issue of activism. too, when they say, oh, let's do something subversive. You know, I spent 3 years in jail for subverting the order under a dictatorship. So I said, okay, let's do this subversive thing. But I also grew up with my mother, a painter, and I saw their model working in Latin America. I mean, that's how people publish in Latin America, and that's how artists show their way, their work. And the collective of artists, visual artists, made a lot of sense for me. The galleries, the co-ops, right down there. So we went to Argentina together in the year 2000 for a big women's conference, and I saw there Griselda Gambaro, who is the most important playwright of Latin America. And she was, you know, giving us books and stuff. And I said, wow, isn't this amazing that everybody has a book to give? And we coming from the United States we had to buy our books, mm-hmm. right, to distribute there. But everybody was giving their books that they printed themselves. And I told Griselda, isn't that a pity that you had to print your books for so many years until people recognized your worth? And she says, no. And that was a moment of revelation. She said, why I can't do what Griselda Gambaro does?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm... Yeah. I completely agree with that. And I, you know... For me, I think it's slightly different. I don't have a MFA. I have a PhD in English because I needed to have a job. I'm the first one in my family to go to college, so I didn't have that luxury of, you know, or drinking myself to death or anything like that. So that was out. Yeah. The other option, I mean, I started to learn that there is these community writers here in L.A., that I respect a lot, and that to me is very meaningful to be part of their community and to work in this kind of more cooperative sense to make things happen instead of relying on other people to do it for us, and then you end up disappointed. Mm-hmm. So it seemed like a much more effective, practical model, and it wasn't provincial. You know, we're from very different backgrounds, so we learned from each other in that sense. And so when we began to talk, there were a lot of interesting ideas that appealed to me. One of them was that we wouldn't translate anything from Spanish to English in our books, or we wouldn't put them in italics. This seemed very necessary in a place like LA, and it's never been the case until I just heard at the AWP conference, the University of Wisconsin has now... established that as policy. They will no longer italicize this Spanish in their texts or translate them. And I think that's a very positive move, and one that we should have done in LA a long time ago, and it's probably going to take the publishing industry much, much longer. So these sort of ideas really appealed to me. They seemed much more current to the reality of what people want to read and how they read and how they live.
I think I have a romantic idea of a collective. And a couple of you have mentioned the word arguing. And so I'm going to ask you, Gail, and anyone else chime in. I mean, I think of sort of Bloomsbury and the ant farm and people sipping wine and exchanging ideas. And I'm sure that's part of it for you. But tell me how you, you know, what how the process works, how you decide which of your own pieces of work you're going to bring to the table, how do you all talk about it, how you help each other.
Me?
Yeah, you.
Okay. Well, I was just going to go in another direction, which I'll start with just briefly before I get to that, which is that, you know, another part of this that's really important to me is that writing is such a solitary thing, and in this country in particular, it's so many writers are just concerned about their own books, their own work, their own careers, and this seemed to me to be such a great opportunity to just get rid of that whole business and just be about supporting a group of writers, you know, that, and when we try to mention each other's books when we do readings, we do a lot of readings together. And but, you know, we're all individuals and we all have a lot of really different opinions about things when you get right down to it. So, and I think that this is, a collective is maybe something that the Latin American members of our collective are a little more at ease with and at home with culturally. And for the rest of us, I think we struggle, and we still struggle with, wait a minute, is this about me or about us, you know? And how to make decisions and what directions to go in, and all of that is, you know, that's not smooth. But we eat great food when we get together, yeah. You know, and that helps a lot.
We don't have a hierarchy. We are all 12 people trying to work this out, generally 9 people, because 3 of the people communicate by email, and it's harder for them. And we've learned that, too, that it's as a Los Angeles collective, it's harder for people to be outside. But there are just tons of issues. Do you advertise who... Where do you advertise, and how do we pay for it? You asked about having submissions. Well, when are we going to take submissions? How are we going to do it? Are we going to have new members? How are we going to do that? And those are, you know, all difficult questions. And we're still talking about some of that.
Mostly is how subversive we are, right? Because the models we see around us, do we try to get reviews in the big newspapers? Do we invest all of our energy here? Do we use these other means? And we are learning, and we are not as young as those art and writers collectives that started in 2003 around this country, and they are savvier than us with all the technology and they take more risks there. So we have been socialized as writers in other ways, and so that's mostly what we're trying to shape it. We're looking, and there are models out there. We haven't reinvented the wheel. I mean, we just put it in a nice postcard by Gronk. It's not, you know, we have to look at different models, but we are in a moment of transition.
Are there particular kinds of work that are well-suited to this process? You know, Ramon, is there a poem that you... work that would really benefit from the collective process, as opposed to going to a, I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think you get your work edited by writers you respect. It's always smoother because you agree a lot more. Mm-hmm. There's always, you know, editors are different, and sometimes you disagree with them, and sometimes if you don't want to make those changes, they won't publish you in their magazine or their anthology. And that's something that we don't really have to worry about because we respect each other's work and we sort of work collaboratively. And also, one thing that I think is very important is just, at least it was for me, although it seems a bit superficial, I wanted a nice cover for my book. And, you know... There's anthologies that I've been in, and you lose all enthusiasm when you see the cover. And they're very stereotypical. They play in these stereotypes that somebody in some marketing department thought people wanted to see or wanted to buy. I don't know how they come up with those ideas. I don't think it's accurate. I think that readers are much more savvy, especially younger ones. They want to see something different, and they want to see something challenging. Not the same old stereotype over and over again from, you know, not only what's inside, but from in the cover. That, to me, maybe I'm superficial, but I wanted something to look at. I buy books because they're of their covers sometimes. And I think a lot of times you can't judge a book by its cover. I don't think that is true.
Yeah.
So that to me was very important. And when we had Gronk along and he won, you know, that was actually a lot of fun. It was very meaningful because, you know, yeah, it was fun. And also you're proud of it. You don't have to hide it. You can share it and it feels good.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think in mainstream publishing, the writer really isn't supposed to even weigh in on what the book looks like. That's sort of like, you know, thou shalt not.
Well, I think even in small press, here's your cover. How do you think about it? Well, that's your cover.
Right. Stop complaining.
I just saw the cover of my next book in Argentina. I saw it on Facebook. It was posted on the back of a magazine advertising. I just saw it. They haven't sent it to me. I respect those publishers, but they are already advertising it with that cover.
I mean, one of the things that is somewhat subversive, I think, and liberating about this model is we're about making books, not about making money. And that just keeps us afloat because we don't care.
And we are not just about making books. That's what sometimes we are transitioning towards. I mean, the artists, right? Because Gronk says his is a book. His is a piece of work of art that happens to be a book. That's how he introduced his work, right? And so we are trying to figure out other ways of doing things with our books. There is not just books, right? The creating a sense of community, creating, organizing other events.
Right.
But we are starting. And there's a lot of interest out there. I mean, people want to publish, right? So I'm sure. And once we open with the audience, and people need, and I say, well, let's replicate our model. This is one of the things that we thought. Just replicate with what you have, and with your friends, and with the other artists, create. And there are those communities out there, but you can't replicate the model. That was the idea.
Yeah, and one of the things we'd like to do is hook up with other groups, not just publishing collectives, but artist collectives and activist groups.
And
I mean,
performing
arts, and you know, so the Glass Table Collective. I mean, What Books Press is What Books Press. What we do is publish books, but the collective plans and hopes to be involved in many other things.
So, how will you decide what to publish? How do you decide?
We decided in the first 2 years members in the collective would, so we would publish the members of the collective, and the work was put forward, and somebody volunteers to edit it, somebody volunteers to copy edit it, and that's how we've done it. Now, the second step we've made is that members of the collective can act as contributing editors, can nominate two people outside the collective a year and nominate work to the collective. And so our next list will have a non-member. And one of our members nominated two people. We fought about them for a year and finally decided to publish one of them.
We fought about the idea, growing now or later.
Yeah.
That was the
fight. Well, we talked about the work, too. We had to discuss the work and what kind of work do we want,
right.
to publish. But then we hope to move to opening submissions, having contests, and at least this is just the book aspect, and doing it like a press.
And can I just add, when you say the kind of work, are there?
Well, the prose, our prose tends to be fabulous. The prose writers are not realist writers. Dionantis's book is a book set in the 13th century about Master Seeger with all late 21st century technology. So you've
20th
got
century.
20th century? I'm sorry, what did I say, 19th?
21st.
Oh, okay, late 20th century. There are these centuries. And other Franciscan highway patrols, and the Pope takes people to play virtual golf and discuss Aristotle. And it's just a very odd fabulous book, and Kate Hake is a eco-fabulist writer. I'm a fabulous writer, and I suppose Camoin would be the most conservative, but he was one of my teachers, and when we were starting this out, he had, you know, gone through a period of not writing, and I just said no. But he does some odd stuff. So the prose is, I don't care, you could try to characterize the poetry, but the prose is not, I would say Philip Roth, but Philip Roth has his moments, I guess. Mm-hmm. So it's, and he steps aside, but it's not Eggers. Mm-hmm. How's that?
Yeah, the poetry might be a little harder to characterize. Mm-hmm. Because we aren't, you know, none of us belong to a particular school, right? And there's a lot of variety in our work. But somehow, you know, we all just have a tremendous amount of respect for each other. And that's why we're together. I don't think that there's anything that necessarily identifies.
What about place? What about L.A.? How does L.A. figure into the...
Well, I mean, Gilbert addresses is usually the best, but we really, and this is one of the, I guess, one of the things about having people from outside L.A., we're starting to realize how important L.A. is to us and about defining ourselves as Los Angeles writers and the concerns of Los Angeles writers, the issue of Latino and Latina writers and the issue of the environment. And there are just ways of characterizing Los Angeles writers is not necessarily doing noir or writing about Hollywood or gangs or surfing, but they're breaking out of that niche, defining ourselves, as opposed to letting New York define, mm-hmm. you know, what Los Angeles is. That I state, they usually say that a bit. Did okay with that, Gail?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Ramon and I talked a bit on the phone, and we agreed that we weren't going to spend a lot of time wringing our hands about big publishing. But I just have to ask. I'm a book critic, and I do feel a lot of the time like a bit of a dinosaur. And I'm just wondering, you know, where does the reviewing process? How does that matter to you? Does it?
Yeah,
figure
it matters
into,
a lot.
Yeah,
it does. And the fact that Chuck's book, the India book, and Kevin Cantwell's book of poetry got starred reviews from Booklist. Mm-hmm. You know, when that was our first list of books, and it came out, and those two books were featured, and that was really exciting. You know,
sold
it
books.
Really was, and it sold books.
So it is, you know, a little bit about money, but it's also about.
Well, you want, it's not so much money as you want people to read your book, right? And so sales indicate that at least they've bought it, so mm-hmm. maybe they'll be reading it. You do want to distribute the work.
It would on what do you get, 10% royalty in New York? I think I got small presses here. I got 5% and some others that don't give me any of my money. When the author gets 90% royalties here. So when they go back and cover when the production costs are covered by that 90%, then it goes to the author. And mm-hmm. so if you sell you don't have to sell, after that point, you don't have to sell a lot of books to start, because that's the way it should be. Mm-hmm. And so the press doesn't have to make money. The author,
and
the
we
author
had
can.
To learn how to time our release. I mean, we knew a lot about outreaching. We have our networks. We know about reading and we put together all of our resources. But then all the administrative stuff, it's so time-consuming, and so we had to learn when to send those copies. Send them timely. If you don't send them timely, you don't get reviewed. That is mm-hmm. not, you know, you don't even get considered. So those things, I got a lot more respect for the other publishers, because I know the amount of work that it takes, and especially for small presses to do this.
Yeah, I just know the amount of work Karen does in design is just voluminous, and it's a good thing I didn't know how hard this was when I took over managing this,
but we got a lot of support from another small press.
From another small press from Hollyridge in Venice, they really had my back when I would just call up and say, I don't know what to do. I'm on this website, and how do I communicate with the Library of Congress, mm-hmm. which you have.
So it's about solidarity,
learn, that's the
kind of, right?
You have to learn how to you get ISBNs and copyright and how do you communicate to a printer. Mm-hmm. It's but see, you can do it. It was completely against my nature. Someone had to do it, and we did. And we did. And other people you find in the collective have stepped up. You know, Molly has stepped up with a number of, you know, readings and at bookstores. Molly Bendall, and each of us have Ramon helping us with
taking to Guadalajara to the book fair of Guadalajara,
right.
To ILBA, the international, the Latino book festival, and
Antonio has helped us with the, you know, on the websites. We've divided up, and none of us are experts. But
so you've eliminated the distributor. You distribute all your own. No, you do have a distributor. You do have a
source. SPD.
Okay.
And Amazon and
And you print on demand.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Offset is so expensive, and we couldn't warehouse. Where would we put books? I don't know.
Which is one of the things that has brought big publishing down, is this backlisting and back orders, and you know
they are printing on demand. Yeah. We have more and more.
Well, Oxford, Cambridge, a lot of the universities are printing.
But there are places that won't review you if you're print on demand, and there are prizes. You can't contest. You can't enter the books
really?
In if you're print on demand, and so there's that whole world is lagging, I think, because really so many presses. Are using print on demand.
And for a while, bookstores wouldn't right. order books. But that's breaking down because there's more and more POD.
Well, I think you've answered this question, but it's a political act forming a collective. Yeah, it's a political choice. Mm-hmm. Is that too heavy?
No.
Can I respond to that? Well, I mean. It's not like we're doing it from scratch. I mean, in the modern period, there were a lot of great examples. I mean, the surrealist work, to some extent, collectively, and as a collective, the Company of Raw Art in France after the war, they were great. The Fluxus group in the United States, and you know, more into art, but it's not like we're reinventing the whole wheel. There are models, but. I mean, we have to do it our own way, and we are in Los Angeles. I mean, I think we're aware of that, and we think about that. It's just a matter, I think, we have different talents and different capabilities and different ways of doing things, and we all contribute whatever we can, you know. Ideally, ideologically, we want it to be equal, but realistically and practically, Chuck ends up doing most of the work, which we love him for it. But, I mean, we try. I mean, I think we're accepting, I think, of our you know, our limitations, too. But, you know, we do get into arguments, but it's like a family, you know. You respect the person, so you get things done in the end because you have respect for who they are and their writing too. So
and you've all put together lives. I mean, in the way that writers do, you right. teach or you don't teach. Some writers don't. You do your writing. You do whatever else you need to do to pay the rent and keep writing.
You know the
I'm
other
thinking.
Thing
teaching.
about
traveling this
to Bhutan.
Another thing I want to say about the politics is that it's no accident. That Gronk is a member of this collective because, I mean, you know, people might not have ever found out about Gronk. He might not have had a career had he and Harry Gamboa Jr. not signed their names on LACMA. You know, I mean, this was a subversive political act. And they were part of OSCO, an artist group. And so, you know, we like to think that some of what we're doing is similar to that gesture. Yeah.
I think also it gets back to something that Alicia mentioned, that, you know, being political and being on the left, as obviously all of us are, doesn't mean that you have to create bad art. and Gronk is a good example of that. There's, you know, he's always been very involved in politics. Most people assume he hasn't been because he creates you know, very, very good art. And I think there's that understanding that, you know, that artistic excellence is first, but that obviously we're political people and we're going to consider what we do as something that is political. And that's the way I saw it.
And we're also all real playful, I think, too. I mean, I think, you know, that's like the giant claw. You know, we share that. It's not all literature and politics.
Well, I want to live in your country. So I want to open it up for questions.
Okay.
Yeah. And then after the questions, everyone's going to sign books up front. So, yes.
How often do you meet?
Once a month,
at least.
At least, yeah.
For 3 or 4 hours.
But there's good food. Well, it's kind of like a potluck and lots of wine. So it doesn't seem like a meeting. It seems more like a get-together, but we do get things done.
More questions? Okay.
Should we cross the barrier of politics? My question is, any opinions about the current president's comments of his travels today and his trip that's planned for Central and South America of forgetting about the past?
That's all yours.
His books get more distribution than ours. I read this poem about the bomber at Fallujah, and I was thinking in Tripoli, and I wish we were not bombing yet another country. I know, according to some poll, 7 out of 10 people in the States agree with the bombing. I hope this is not the crowd with that. Yeah.
Well, and you asked about his trip to Latin America and South America. I don't know what he did in he's in Chile now.
Oh, the nuclear. Yeah, yeah. Well, right. That's what happens. So. They silently signed this nuclear agreement with Chile. They're gonna write. See, they're going to build nuclear plants, and he was supposed to sign it openly there with, and now they had the foreign ministers sign it before his trip behind doors. And so I guess Japan's tragedy is probably making people nervous.
Well, thank you so much for coming. And oh, I'm sorry. We have one more. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I can't see. So.
Hi. My question is related to, wow, it's weird to hear your voice. In terms of working with the big publishing houses, you have the collective, obviously. Do all of you still work with big publishing houses at all? And if so, how do you balance doing that versus the collective stuff you do?
We're free to. No member of the collective has to publish in the collective. There's been some interest because this book has sold some, and there's some agent interest in this. And I suppose if an agent wanted to take this and move it to a big publisher, and I'd let that happen, and I think we would let any. So we work with other publishers, besides ourselves, and publish other places. We try to promote the collective as much as possible in any situation where one of us reads and.
But if they asked you to change something vital about the book, that would be different.
Well, that's one of the things about knowing that the next book I write, I'm not worrying about aiming at a particular press, you know, like the creative process is not affected by that feeling that, oh, I've got to sell this, or I've got to impress so-and-so with this, or, you know, it's very liberating just from the writing point of view not to be thinking about that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I would like to, first of all, I'd like to thank you, and I'd like to also say that you've made very clear how esteemed and established you are as writers, and I know that personally. I love your poetry, Gail. But I'd like to make a common reference to Ms. Reynolds' statement about being political. And one phrase that hasn't been uttered, but I'll use it, is self-publishing. I read Andrea Dworkin's introduction to In Our Blood, and she was a feminist, and she had written a piece, or I can't recall if it was a full magazine article, if it was a book, but she sold it, and she was delighted, except that they shelved it. They wouldn't publish it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I said to myself, that's not going to happen to me. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I think, you know, where you really do need to be not self-editing. You need editors. In fact, Chuck, when you were talking about having to deal with various aspects of publishing, you know, you find that it's as isolated as you can be as a writer. You know, you have to deal with a lot of people. And so that you need, you know, you do need others. You need editors. But I think that, you know, speaking of your collective, what about the Cahuenga Press? I mean, there are many local and, you know, long-standing presses here in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. Right, absolutely. Most of us reject the phrase self-publishing because it has the word self in it, you know, and I think that we really like to see ourselves as a group. But yeah, I think that there is something very political, like my bringing up Gronk, you know, and the subversive act of spray painting his name on LACMA. Well, if Gronk and Harry Gamboa Jr. had waited for LACMA to ask them for paintings, you know, they'd probably still be waiting, you know. I also think, you know, there's a funny thing that happens with writers. It's, you know, filmmakers raise money for their own films, you know, however they can, and they're considered entrepreneurial and self-starting and that kind of thing. And musicians now, it's more than ever musicians, and I know this because our daughter's a musician, you know, go into the studios, rent studio time, make their own records, and give them to radio stations. Listen to KXLU. All they play is music that's non-label, you know. So, and I think that yet with writing, there's still this little bit of a stigma, like vanity publishing, which, you know, I just think it is ridiculous, and I reject it. And I want to say that the book that you self-published, Marn, is quite a wonderful book, and I'm really glad that you did it.
Hey. My name is Kelly Clifton, and I really enjoyed the panel a discussion here this evening. I would like to know who would I speak to regarding film rights and documentary rights to the collaborative. Who would I speak with?
All of us.
When is your next meeting?
Well, I guess I'm kind of the funnel for that.
When is your next meeting?
In April sometime. We haven't decided. So, but we really, I think that would be a collective.
Yes, I wouldn't make the decision. No, I wouldn't make the decision.
Documentary interviews on camera.
Excuse me?
Documentary interviews on camera. Who would I speak with? In the next meeting? Well,
any of us.
Any of us.
Yeah.
Oh, any of you. Okay.
Yeah. Well,
In other words, I'm inviting myself.
But you just don't get to come to the meetings.
Right,
it's just us. So that's something we're talking about is who gets to come to the meetings. So that's something you'd have to air it with one of us, and then one of us would bring it to the collective to talk about you coming.
And can people communicate with you through the website? Yeah. Is that a good way?
Yes.
There's a blog and a website. It's www.whatnot. Is that
what?
No, I'm sorry. What book?
What
book?
WWW.
What book?
It could be WhyNot.
Press.com.
What book's done? Yeah.
Hi there. Thank you so much for your panel. I'm curious to know, can you describe just briefly how you criticize each other and how do you say, this poem sucks? How do you say, you know, the ending of this novel is not working? How do you do that as a collective and how do you, I guess, agree on that?
That's done by the editor. It's not done collectively. So if, I edited... Master Seeger, and I'll be editing this new submission, and I'm the editor. I say, why don't you drop the first 14 pages of this book? Or, you know, your characters are sighing all the time. Why don't you dump 90% of the sighs? You just say this is stuff you'd say to someone when you edit their book.
The difference is a friend tells you that, as opposed to this letter saying, you know, take your book to a children books publisher, or things like that, and your book, go to some workshop. You've received those letters, right? Go to some writer's work. You've received
those. Yeah, I get those.
And for the poets, we read each other's work long before it's a book, yeah. Somebody like Karen will send me 10 poems. These are my newest 10 poems. And so the conversation happens really early on in that process for the poets.
And in the translation process, right. too, like translating her book, and now she's translating. I mean, in that translation process, you realize this is not working. and she said, this poem won't work. Maybe in Spanish, and then really, it doesn't even work in Spanish. So...
There's also a comfort level when it's, you know, people that you admire. I mean, I'm speaking for myself, but I had four great poets read my work and give me great advice, and I felt very comfortable asking them, do you think I should take out this line or, you know, the ending here or the beginning? You know, if there's a comfort level there that's very satisfying, at least to me, because you respect the other people's work and you know what they're talking about. So that makes it just your labor much much more satisfying than other experiences I've had where I've had to explain what a word means in Spanish
to someone
five
you don't
times.
Know, to someone you've never met.
Someone doesn't care, but they're trying. They're pretending like they are. They do. Those things are kind of eliminated when you're working with friends. You know, you're all. It's okay to disagree. You know, that doesn't. You know, it's something productive in the end. I've learned a lot from it, actually. And I think for me, it's been a great privilege to work with, you know, writers I admire. And it's, you know, I don't see it as something that's been a struggle for me, at least.
So okay. Good. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.